Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 341.
This week on the podcast, the Empire consolidated just in time to dash the hopes of anybody dreaming of a future more promising than not Trump.
And we moved up our primary, but California's Super Tuesday somehow still didn't count.
Plus, with last week's carnage, the Senate races are our new raison d'etre.
And luckily, Tuesday, March 10th brings new possibilities.
But we'll have to make it through coronavirus to get there.
And one thing that's keeping our emotional health in check, we beat MSNBC. Chris Matthews is no more.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey guys, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com. And we promised a special guest for you this week, and we delivered. My mother, Carla, is here once again.
Hi.
To discuss the great tragedy that was Super Tuesday. But also give us some direction moving forward.
She's got a more hopeful message also.
That's right. That's what we rely on, like the time that you said but don't remember saying nothing can't be undone, that we really took to heart and then told everyone repeatedly, that you then denied having said, even though you were definitely the first one to say it. So we're bringing a nothing can't be undone vibe to this podcast.
Yeah.
This last weekend was crazy. We recorded the podcast, and then on Monday...
Right, we were on cloud nine... Sunday night.
Polls were looking up.
We had just come back from a Bernie Sanders rally and everything was great.
That's right. Yeah. And then Monday morning, like everyone dropped out of the race and endorsed Joe Biden.
I think actually Buttigieg had dropped out on Sunday.
Yes. But we mentioned that.
Right. We did mention that. And we were happy to see him go. At that point, we didn't realize where things were going to go south.
But then Klobuchar dropped out soon after. Both of them endorsed Biden that Monday. Suddenly, it seemed like the establishment...
At a huge rally in Texas that Beto O'Rourke also endorsed that.
Right. It suddenly seemed like the establishment had a pick. And then we were off to the races because everyone freaked out, voted for Joe Biden in the primary on Super Tuesday. And the only states that Bernie Sanders won were California.
Yes.
Not a minor state.
No, not at all.
But then Colorado, Vermont, and Utah.
Yeah.
And then the South, which we maybe should have expected. I think we were... feeling a little optimistic because polls in Texas had been showing that Sanders was leading. I think we probably should have thought to ourselves, okay, well, where did Sanders run into trouble last time?
Right.
It was in the South. All of the Deep South seems to vote on one day on Super Tuesday, which is not a great thing for progressives. And so we just sort of got slaughtered out there.
Yeah.
And then we also got slaughtered in Texas, which was a very unfortunate thing.
Also, I think people had higher hopes for Massachusetts. People had higher hopes for
Massachusetts,
Minnesota, even though, especially after Amy Klobuchar dropped out, what was interesting was I was just like, it's weird to me that she's dropping out now because it seems like Sanders is probably going to win Minnesota now. But that didn't even happen, actually. So
everything coalesced around Biden very quickly. And it felt like we had whiplash.
Yeah. Well, it did. I mean, it was just sort of like, and it felt like, I still feel like I have whiplash, and not even necessarily because of how, I mean, definitely because of how Super Tuesday went, but what has been so weird about the whole thing is because, like, you know, I've been on, you know, wanting Sanders to win for a long time, but I feel like there's always been a part of me that, like, never felt like that he would.
Right.
Even though things were, like, looking good for a while. It's almost not even that it went poorly for him that I feel like I'm so upset about. It just seems so shocking to me that we've gotten to this point where it's him and Biden.
Yeah, and Biden...
That's what's so bizarre to me. I'm like, really? That's what we're getting at now? Like,
I think part of it,
guy?
Biden is such a compromised candidate that it, to a Sanders supporter, and if you're wondering why Sanders supporters are feeling so down in your life, this is maybe a good thing for you to know. But like, because I had a few, you know, conversations with people who were like, but at least Biden can win. And I was like, I think my frustration is my feeling that Biden can't win and that we have now backed ourselves up into, I was not the only person who made this joke on Twitter, but I did it best. I'm not sure I did. But the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different result. Well, we're doing the same thing again and again and again and we're expecting a different result.
Except
we did it with
this
Gore.
Time
we did it
with
Kerry.
Less complete sentences.
Right. We did it with Clinton and now we're doing it. Biden is incredibly conservative, but also isn't out there making so much sense, you guys. And that was why he started to flag in polls in the first place, if you recall. And then the second part of him flagging in polls was that he's incredibly conservative. Like, in a like, supports the Hyde Amendment still kind of way. So, like, that was a little shocking.
Right.
But then, so, Steyer dropped out.
Right.
And so...
Because he had put... That was happened after
South Carolina.
He had spent tens of millions of dollars there.
Right. So, by the time we headed into Super Tuesday, we were in this awkward situation where there were two progressive candidates and only one moderate. And I was not in the camp that thought that Liz Warren should have dropped out.
But I mean,
Bloomberg, who was, I guess, sort of helped head off some of the Biden enthusiasm. But
right. I think outside of Bernie, who was obviously most directly hurt by all of these people dropping out, it was also all of the sort of establishment people coalescing around Biden. I think he was the next person who was hurt the worst because he thought that he was going to do much better on Super Tuesday. And the reason that he didn't was because I think a lot of people who waited, who were thinking that maybe they were going to vote for him, did not.
Yeah, I think they all...
Yeah, I think another part of it was the fact that by dropping out the day before the biggest primary, they basically, because of early voting, they delivered a very bad message to their voters, which was they did not care about their vote. And basically said, you know, we don't care. We weren't there on principle or anything. It's all very political, and we're going to go with the guy who we think is going to give us something. So I think that was one part of it. I think the other part of it that's very hard on Sanders voters and very discouraging is I don't think anybody voted for Joe Biden because they thought he would make a good president.
Yes.
I think everyone who voted for him did it because they had this idea that he's the only one who could win, and that's ridiculous.
Right. I think that's ridiculous, too. And I think what I have been saying is that, like, I don't even know that they were thinking – they weren't thinking about November when they voted. The only thing that they were thinking about was beating Bernie Sanders on Super Tuesday. You know what I mean? Like, I think they had a great plan to stop Sanders. Mm-hmm. But a plan to stop Sanders is not necessarily the same plan that you use to win the presidency in November. Like, those are separate plans you have to have.
Yeah, but I'm not even sure they had a plan. I think it just...
It came together.
Yeah.
Because it was so fast.
It seemed very slapdash.
And these are not thoughtful people. I mean, they've been messing up on elections for decades.
I do think that this... I agree with you. I think that whatever happened, I think, was probably... You know, this Joe Biden campaign has been run very shoddily and, you know, has on a shoestring, and they're not even doing events and whatever. I think that this is the thing that they probably, at least in part, were responsible for, whether it was them or it was just the establishment. But, like, I'm sure that he made phone calls, and I'm sure that he made promises. And whether we like that or not, and we certainly don't because it didn't end up great for us, like, it was... well played on his part, I suppose, probably. Or the all of their parts. I mean, not necessarily his, but I mean,
I'm not sure it was he who played that game. It may not have been. I think it's people played that game because his people are, you know, have a lot to lose. I mean, the amount of money these people are going to lose if someone like Bernie Sanders was elected it's substantial.
Sure.
And also the message that you can do it without the corporate donors, you can do it with just the people.
Yeah.
I think they were the ones that, you know, that cobbled this together. And
I think to some extent, though, I mean, we've seen throughout Biden's candidacy that he's someone who can't apologize for past mistakes. He's somebody who sort of has been running as if he's owed this, as opposed to running a campaign based on any significant ideas. Because I think I heard his first speech that maybe referenced some policy, like, after he won all these states on Super Tuesday, basically. And I will note, before you add us, Brent and I went and saw every single candidate.
Yeah,
so
we saw him.
We saw him speak, and we've seen every one of these guys speak. And so when we saw him speak, what he was spending most of his campaign rallies doing was doing individual shout-outs in the audience to random people that were, like, old-timey political donors and local politicians, not from the area that we were in, by the way. So he was not exactly there to be strong on policy.
No.
He told us about the bulging veins in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
He showed us that horror show of an ad that he made when he first announced.
Mm-hmm.
And then he told us to be really scared. And then he told us a sad story about his life. And we all know that he has had some great tragedy in his life. And people keep saying to me, but you have to, it's so easy to connect with him because, you know, he's so sensitive when he talks about these issues. And like, great. I mean, certainly we can all understand what a sort of tragedy Biden's losing not only, you know, children years ago, but also recently losing Beau. Like, we all understand that, like, empathy is a thing. That really isn't the same thing as voting for someone with a principled policy platform.
Right.
And I think maybe one misunderstanding that we're now going to have to battle that is going to be our next frontier if Sanders doesn't pick up steam is how to make those centrists understand what the left actually wants. Because what they don't want is like a sort of symbolic gesture. They don't want a sort of identity politics gesture where he appoints a running mate who like sort of increase, you know, is representative of some group that's been excluded from the process, but politically offers the left nothing.
Yeah.
The left wants change. The left needs something to happen.
History tells me that that's
that
not
won't happen. I know. Right.
They haven't been able to do it. I mean, I remember the first time with this in my own memory was my first presidential vote in 1968. And they have never acknowledged the left. And they have never acknowledged the young.
When we see it all the time, the left just gets, they use the left as a scapegoat. They gaslight us about what our role was. You saw this after Gore. You certainly saw this after Clinton. You know, if you are a person who is still walking around blaming Ralph Nader for George Bush, then like you need to sort of figure out what has happened in your life that has led you to produce such a wildly illogical, you know, fact. Like, this is sort of how they operate. And so they do not have an incentive to, I mean, their incentive should be winning elections, but they're not good at that. They don't know how to win elections, so they don't know how to do that. But I mean, they really like have not, and I think I agree that there is no time in history that we have seen the sort of centrist wing of the Democratic Party do anything to bring the left in.
Yeah.
And when they do make attempts, what I'm sort of worried about is when they do make attempts, they often think that they can shroud those attempts in the same symbolism that they shroud attempts to reach their own base in. Their own base is not looking for specific policy, because their own base is out there telling us they want Medicare for all and is just not voting for it.
Yeah.
So their own base is not there because of policy. They're there because of incrementalism. They're there because they believe in not upsetting the apple cart. That is very different than what the left is looking for. The left is looking for something to actually happen.
Yeah.
And if they can't offer that, then I think, A, you know, we're going to end up with a Republican president before we can blink our eyes, even if Joe Biden does somehow pull this off. And B, we're going to be looking at a Democratic Party that still has learned no lessons about how to win moving forward.
Yeah.
Is going to have lost this. There's an incredibly active and large group of young people coming up right now. And to lose them would be, I mean, a sort of critical loss to the Democratic Party.
Yeah, one of the things that, having come from a lost generation, which people don't believe this now, but the boomers were a totally lost generation. And it goes back to 1968, which actually this election reminds me a lot of, because it's
so
fraught.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying that.
And what three things that happened with 1969 that happened with young voters at that time, which were incredible, was first of all, they ran out a popular president because of the war in Vietnam. They were the ones with Eugene McCarthy as their candidate, ran him out. The second thing that happened was their candidate that they had gravitated to was murdered the night of the
California primary.
And one of the things, and it's just struck me recently, I've always thought, and I think people thought at the time, oh my gosh, it was so sad. It was heartbreaking and horrible. But the thought was, he's a Kennedy, and this is what happens to Kennedys. And it's only been very recently that it's occurred to me, no, wait a minute, this is what happens when you don't want a candidate there. It can go that far. And so for this generation, they saw their a candidate murdered, and then they were slaughtered at the Democratic convention.
Right. Yeah.
And so when the Democrats said, oh, no, you just don't understand, you know, we just have to do it our way, this is the only way to win, and then, of course, they lost with Hubert Humphrey, is they that generation walked away. But I maintain they could walk away because you can end a war, and eventually the war did end. You cannot end climate change without action.
Yeah.
So the younger generation today doesn't have that option.
Yeah.
And they may have to take out the Democratic Party, because the Republican Party is on its way out anyway.
Sure.
Well, the Democratic Party is on its way to becoming the Republican Party. So if the Republican Party disappears, something will need to happen.
You know, and you brought up so many people in the Democratic Party love to use McCarthy as McGovern in 72, because he was the big anti-war candidate, and people use him as like this huge scapegoat for like how liberals can't win elections, but it's, you know, moderates don't have a secret key to elections
either. But it's not only that. Then something to think about is that eight years before, in 1964, Barry Goldwater ran against Lyndon Johnson, and he was very, very conservative, off the charts crazy conservative. By 1980, an off the charts crazy conservative was elected president.
Sure.
And so they keep saying, "Oh, it can't be done with liberal candidates like McGovern." There have not been any liberal candidates like McGovern who have run since 1972.
Right, exactly.
Yet we have had many instances of wackadoodle Republicans, and this being the worst example, the one we have now, of winning. So, I mean, that just doesn't hold any water.
I agree. And also, you know, we all sort of like thought George W. Bush was wackadoodle, and he was in his way. But I feel like we're sort of like getting into this sort of like this back and forth between like wingnut Republicans and then like some sort of Democrat that isn't as different as you would want them to be.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like status quo Democrats and wingnut Republicans, and there is no part.
At a certain point, I want the wingnut lefty.
Right? Right. Like, well, and that's, I feel like
how come
also,
I can't have that? The Republicans can have Donald Trump. Why can't I have Bernie Sanders?
Right. And we keep also talking about, the other thing that I think I've noticed is that we have reframed what it is to be progressive to the extent that we are acting like Jimmy Carter was a wingnut progressive, and he
wasn't.
Was not.
Really,
no,
he was quite conservative. He really sort of like started the pro business
sort of new Democrats Clinton era of the party.
That we give Clinton a lot of credit for, and we should give him a lot of credit for that. But I mean, it was beginning with
we've sort of been in a frame where we're not even allowed to think outside, and that's what I think is so challenging about
Sanders, by the way. Too.
I saw that.
I
think. Well, I think Carter tries to be a decent person.
is what
Carter tries to do.
Carter was our best example of what a president should become.
Right.
I mean,
for sure.
Yeah, he's the best ex-president that we've ever had.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think to some extent we've been stuck in sort of this Reagan frame for so long that the idea of a Sanders presidency sounds wackadoodle to everybody, but is in fact quite moderate in a lot of European countries. I have a new idea that I've come up with.
Great.
Which is not, you know what, let the Republicans keep their wackadoodleness and let these centrist Democrats have a place to feel home. But we need a third party on the left that does represent the one third of the populace that is in favor of these ideas, if not more.
Yeah.
And we actually should allow this to be the moment that we get rid of the two-party system, because there is not room in their tent for me.
Right? Yeah.
And I am sick of people saying that they have a bigger tent. They have a smaller tent. Their tent is geared to the interests of fewer people, and it doesn't leave room for representation of someone like me, because their tent swallows candidates that represent my interests and tells them they can't have funding unless they mitigate their beliefs.
Yeah.
Right. Well, they're all about the money.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're young, and there's no place there for you. I'm old.
Yeah.
And I've been in this party for over 50 years, and there's no place for me.
No, exactly.
As well.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's... Their whole concern is money going to the DNC and to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
The first question they ask a candidate if they're going to run for office is, well, how much money can you raise and how much money can you bring into this? And like the whole panic over Bernie Sanders was the DNC realized that if Bernie Sanders was elected, and he still could be elected.
Yes.
We have to remember the primary is not over, and a majority of delegates haven't even been given out.
Right now, after Super Tuesday, it is wildly closer than it was in 2016.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
Much closer.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he was behind by hundreds and hundreds of delegates after Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
And was sort of only saved by a win in Michigan, which could, again, happen, because that's coming up. So,
right.
But...
Yeah. But they, I'm sorry, I lost my
question. Oh, that's okay.
You know what?
This happened to me last week.
It happens to all of us on
and
the podcast sometimes.
As it turns out, you can edit this out.
It's
only as live as we claim that it is.
Probably not going to be edited out, because that involves me listening to the whole podcast and editing it.
Okay, great.
So enjoy that moment of reality, listeners. let's talk about the delegate count.
Yeah. Right.
So the delegate count as it stands now, Joe Biden has 664 delegates. Sanders is in second with 573. Warren has 64. Bloomberg has 61. Buttigieg 26. Klobuchar 7. And Tulsi Gabbard has one delegate.
That's going to
come
two.
Up, or two delegates.
Two delegates.
That's going to come up later. So keep that in mind.
File that away.
Obviously, the sort of, and there's still some delegates that haven't been assigned yet.
Right, and they're actually the only delegates that are remain unassigned are in the states that Sanders has won.
So, and well, that's because the other thing that I think
it's going to get closer. He won't overtake him, but like it's like what, like a 90 delegate difference right now. That'll shrink.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the issues that we had on Super Tuesday was California already voted last, and California's vote takes a long time to come in. So the big win of the night of California.
Was Texas. Oh, well, and what,
ended
the big
up looking
the
like Texas, right. But California wasn't reported in time. Right.
And they called it pretty quickly, but like nobody really knew what it was going to look like. And still nobody knows what it's going to look like. I think there's something like 3 million votes yet to count.
So that's more people than live in any of those early voting Super Tuesday states, by the way.
Yeah.
So after Super Tuesday, Warren dropped out. And that caused a new level of drama in the race because there had been two factions in the Sanders movement. Warren people will tell you there was one faction. I would argue that that's erasure of me and my faction. Of people who were angry because Warren didn't drop out when all of those other people who weren't going to win dropped out. And because of that, they feel that votes from the left were lost. That's not really true, you guys. Warren voters, as it's turned out, have been pretty fickle friends to the left. Some of them, great friends to the left. Some of them, quite principled. And I think the candidate herself is quite principled. So I'm not here to argue about Liz Warren. But it turned out that a lot of Warren voters immediately flipped to Biden, which either says that they felt that electability was a more pressing concern and like couldn't in their minds imagine that somebody with their own values could be electable, or that they were sort of intrigued by her intellect and were not really listening to her policy platform. Whichever side of the divide they fell into, it doesn't matter. Warren did not cost Bernie Sanders this election, but she did have a really disappointing showing. And I think there was sort of an outcry just because it sort of feels like, what does a female candidate have to do to get people to vote for them in this country? I think to some degree, I think there were a few things that were sort of unfairly said about that campaign, and then a few things that were quite fairly said about that campaign. I think it was maybe unfair to suggest that they did not make some strategic errors.
And
some big strategic errors that lost them, well, really voters like us.
Well, that's the thing. You know, a lot of people
which
were just
was a critical
sort of
part
like,
of winning with a progressive candidate.
Right. A lot of people are just sort of like, we could have had Liz Warren. We could have had Liz Warren. And it's like, well, we had her for the entire campaign.
Right.
And like, y'all chose not to vote for her for whatever reason it was that you chose not to vote for her. I mean, she was the front runner for more than a minute.
Right.
And she became not the front runner for specific reasons, not just because voters are fickle.
Right.
So, like, yes, I love her too and was sad to see her go, but, like, we can't go around was there sexism in the treatment of her? I'm sure that there was, but, like, also,
that,
like, you know, I mean, she sort of, she tried to please everyone and in turn, you know, ended up pleasing no one. And, like, you know, maybe she didn't know that at the time, but, like,
I think that's
what happened. It's not.
There was a moment, actually, because Brent's been watching that Hillary documentary on Hulu and said, you know, it sounds like her consultants and her advisors had terrible instincts, but her own instincts weren't as bad as what we credited her with. I feel like in Liz Warren's case, that's almost the same situation where her early instincts before she had sort of top line advisors were really good. And then the more that her campaign became sort of entrenched, the worse it got.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent, that kind of cost them. I think there's a question to be asked about why none of these female candidates succeeded.
100%.
That's what I think is the question to
one
ask.
One of the things I think women have to look at is who is advising them when they start to take off. Because I suspect that it's that they bring in men to do that. And I know from having worked on campaigns long ago that the only people who were up front and straight about what was going on were the women people who were working on the campaigns. I remember working on Ramsey Clark's Senate campaign in 1978, and the women would be in there beating on the door and saying, no, you can't do that, you can't do this, you know, you've got to do that, you've got to, and the men would be saying, oh, well, we'll just do this, and this is the way it's got to happen. Yeah. And I think women, if they want to get a woman elected to president, they have to look at the whole process and the whole thing and take that in hand, because I think what they're going to find is that there are a lot of men who, because men are the ones who are always given the credit for doing this kind of stuff. I mean, you look at Obama, it's mainly
men. Can you
men.
Think of any women that helped him get elected?
There are a few, it's mainly men. And I think that what they will find is with these women, where it falls apart is when things start to take off, and then the men who know more than anybody else come in and,
When I think there's, to some extent, also just like, a candidate like Liz Warren reminds us all of, for people who were sort of in my shoes, reminded us of ourselves. Yeah. And for people who were the kind of people that find people like me exasperating, also reminded reminded them of me. And that's a sort of gendered expectation that also worked against Amy Klobuchar and Kamala Harris to some degree. I mean, I think the idea that there is not a way to fund a campaign that, fund a campaign for women that both has money and voters is deeply frustrating, which is why I think you saw so much sort of like outcry.
Well, and I think that also there's a different expectation in the sense that like women are punished more for not being perfect.
Yes.
Because Liz Warren was a very good candidate. And, we have talked about some of the things that we think that she maybe messed up as a candidate. But those are things that could have been forgiven if she was a man. Yes. You know, Kamala Harris, in the beginning, we really dragged her for not knowing what she thought about healthcare. And I would still do it right now. But like that is something that like if she were a man, she could have been forgiven for. And if she got to the right place, then it would have been fine.
Yeah, well, Joe Biden has not yet stated.
I was
going to
say, we're literally,
healthcare.
if you think about some of the the male candidates aren't perfect either, but that's okay. For the women candidates, as soon as there's any sort of like crack in the armor, then they're cooked.
But there's a, Lila, you have your theory about girls. And
I have been saying this all week, so apologies if you've already heard me say it to you personally. But I had an epiphany while I was talking to a friend of mine about what happened to Liz Warren. And this is a female friend who was not a fan of Liz Warren in particular, but is very progressive and just was, sort of on the side that she had not really been a good advocate for progressive values. But I was sort of like, I think that the Warren campaign is a little bit like the audience for the show Girls, where when Girls first came out, I watched it, loved it, and thought, why is everyone so worked up about this? This is a great show. And then I realized that it was like designed in a laboratory to reflect my own experiences back at me. So I instinctively understood what to give people credit for and what to love the characters for despite their flaws, and how, because these were people that populated my own life and that I had chosen to love despite their flaws. Right. And so to me,
I watched one episode of it and I was like, everybody is too terrible to be on television. Yeah. And then I never watched it again.
Well, and I think it took me a minute to be like, why is this getting so much negative attention? And I realized like there's a reason I loved it, which is that it was about my life. And, like, that is too bad if my life is also the life of, like, a bunch of whiny assholes in Brooklyn. But that's everyone's life to some extent is about whiny assholes somewhere. So what are you going to do? But I think the Warren campaign sort of morphed into that, because early on, the Warren campaign seemed to really be signaling that it was going to be a big tent. And that is, I think, where they got caught to some extent, because they started signaling that their tent was so big that Republicans should join it. But also, the diehard supporters
The last ad that she ran in Iowa was like independent and a Republican and Republicans. Democrat all talking independently about why they liked her. And it was like,
But I think to a certain extent, because I cannot think of anyone in my life besides us who did not vote for Liz Warren. So,
I know.
To some extent, I think that her campaign support structure became sort of insular in the way that, the audience of Girls was, where it was reflecting their own experience and life back at them in such a hardcore manner that they stopped having perspective on how it was being interpreted or by other people and how they were articulating their ideas to those other people. Yeah. So at a certain point, the campaign became about a sort of feel-good brand of progressivism that doesn't require you to do anything as scary as criticize the Republican, I mean, the Democratic Party.
Right.
And doesn't require you to sort of think, how can I put my message in simple terms that idiots will understand? Because, sorry, not everyone has the chance to be a super informed voter because it's right. really fucking complicated.
Not everyone, people like that you have plans, but nobody's read any
of them. No one read any of them. And so once they started to hear things like, oh, well, she doesn't really believe in Medicare for All, newsflash, most people weren't going to look up why. And whether your plan actually did allow for that or not. And what, you know, like at a certain point, the sort of insular, and because she had these really high powered women and many high powered men who were sort of leaders in cultural settings and academic settings hawking for her. Mm. And she had the best surrogates in the game. But she did not have anyone who was out, who knew anyone outside of that community going to their friends and saying, you know, you should really vote for Liz Warren.
Yeah.
And that, I think, at a certain point, they sort of, they lost the thread. They lost track of what message. There are, and I say this a lot because I think people think that voters just should be better about everything and should be more informed and should do X, Y, and Z. It is your job to speak to voters. It is your job to message to voters. It's your job to convince voters that you're the best candidate for them. You have to be speaking to them to do that. And that, at a certain point, sort of, you know, you don't want to underestimate voters. You don't want to think, oh, we can just sort of like say anything to these voters and they'll vote for us anyway. That's what Joe Biden is doing. But you also have to be willing to sort of break down your idea into simple parts that they can grasp onto because they don't have time to read all of your plans.
Right.
And they want to know in general what your plan is. So when you have someone like, you know, a Bernie Sanders who just repeats the same message over and over and over. And you know what? The message sounds good and it makes us all think that we all care about each other and it sort of it projects the right values, then that is as effective as having a 600,000 page plan,
right.
If not more effective, because it's something someone can simply pass along instead of just saying that you're intelligent and hoping that that will be enough.
Yeah.
And I think somewhere along the line, the Warren community became so focused on how impressed they were with themselves that they stopped being able to speak to everyone else. It became sort of elitist, not in a way that, you know, I don't think in a destructive way. I don't think in a way that the DNC is elitist.
Right.
But it became elitist in a way where they just sort of lost track of how to talk to regular voters.
Well, and this is like, you're absolutely right. And that what you're talking about right now is the reason that why when you look at voter crossover, they shared more voters with Pete Buttigieg than they shared with anybody else.
Those people were looking for just a smart candidate.
Right. They were, right. Yeah.
And they weren't listening to her ideas.
Somebody who had read books.
Right.
Like,
now I do have one quibble with her campaign before we finish.
I do too.
And but I can't let us go before I mention it. On Election Day, Liz Warren did an interview with The Hill got released in which Liz Warren uses a Republican talking point to bash Sanders' Medicare for All plan. And I know I am not going, I don't want to be someone who like punches left. Because I had said up until, you know, I thought Warren deserved to be in the race. I thought she should stay in the race as long as she wanted. And I still think that having multiple progressive candidates in the race was actually of benefit to the progressive movement. Because it gave us a chance to look like we're having a healthy debate about ideas that made it look like we're part of the spectrum of ideas. But if you don't want to be punching left, if you don't think that punching left is a good idea, then do not use especially when you are the person who first said in an early debate that we should stop using GOP talking points to talk about healthcare.
Right.
Don't fucking tell me that Bernie Sanders wants to raise middle class taxes on the middle class to pay for his healthcare plan.
I know.
You can say your plan is better, but sorry, no one took your plan seriously.
I mean, she spent months trying to explain the difference between taxes and costs to people.
Without saying either word.
Without having to admit herself that she was going to raise taxes.
Yeah.
So.
And then her plan went way out of its way to not do that in a way that was not even feasible.
Right.
No one took her Medicare for All plan seriously. Right.
That's where she lost everything.
But do not validate Republican talking points about this critical issue.
Right.
That is not being an ally to the left. So well, that was my Election Day anger at her.
And my sort of like current anger with her and like, look, I know she's not going to endorse anybody. Everybody's like, who's she going to endorse?
No, she's not going to endorse anybody.
She's not going to endorse anybody. In 2016, she was the only female senator who didn't endorse Clinton in that initial letter where they all sort of like came out collectively and did it. And then she finally endorsed her after like the election was cooked.
Yeah.
So like she's I've seen this movie before. She's not gonna endorse Sanders. I think there's a lot of Sanders people who want her to. And I, for a while, was sort of like on the fence about whether I cared, whether she should or not. And I have thought about it a lot this week. And I think that she should.
Yeah.
Because if she is a person who, to the point where I'm like, I'm gonna, I kind of didn't really hold it against her in 2016 because I saw sort of like what was going on in her head. She is a person who ran in this race. She's a person who obviously agrees with Sanders on all of these things. Her two campaign slogans have been big structural change and dream big, fight hard. If she's really dreaming big and fighting hard, then like she should get on board.
Yeah.
And I am going to be, I'm going to remain upset with her if she doesn't. That's my new, that's new within the last 48 hours.
Oh,
I'm like, how big are you dreaming and hard are you fighting?
I feel like you've been processing a lot this week.
Prove it.
Because texted me on election day and was just like, I'm out.
I literally went, I had therapy on Wednesday, which I was happy to go to.
Right.
And I was like complaining about the election. I was like complaining about the coronavirus. I had other work was a shit show that day. I had a huge pitch that day. I got family. Look, I don't have problems bigger than anybody else's. But I was just like, I am emotionally exhausted.
Right.
And he was like, you have to not worry about the election and you have to not worry about the coronavirus. Two things that we're going to spend most of this podcast talking about.
Yeah.
But like, and I think that's at one point when I know I was like saying the same thing on Tuesday night to you, but like at a certain point this week, I was like, I'm not going
to
check polls this morning.
No.
I'm not going to do all of these things because I was just
sort of like.
Well,
it turns out,
don't
bother checking polls. They don't work.
Yeah, well,
we knew that and then we forgot and then we knew again.
But I just sort of like, I'm back in it.
Yeah.
But like I had to, there was like 48 hours in the middle of the week where I just like I had to put it away.
Yeah. Understandably.
But I'd like to push back on that because I don't think she should endorse anyone
great.
Right now.
I'm happy for pushback.
The reason I don't think she should endorse anyone is I think if she does it, she's basically saying that she wants to be the vice president. And that's not a good position for her.
Mm.
I mean, that's a terrible one. She's too old for one thing, and she also doesn't bring to the ticket what the ticket will need, no matter who the candidate is. But I think that she would make a terrific Secretary of the Treasury or Secretary of Commerce. And I think that it's wise for her to keep those options open.
Well, she should absolutely be able to be part of whatever administration comes out of this.
I think she is too, but like I think I completely agree with you. I guess I'm just sort of like, is she...
Right,
is
did she believe in dreaming big and fighting hard?
Is she thinking about the movement that she was supposedly part of, or is she thinking about herself?
She didn't build a movement, though. That's the difference between her and Sanders.
That's true.
And I was reading a sort of criticism of her campaign earlier where they were just sort of like, you know, she was talking about taking on big structural change everywhere but in the Democratic Party where it is probably most imminently needed. And you just can't win with that message if you're not willing to take it all the way.
Right.
To some extent, I feel like she's positioned herself to be a positive progressive influence on whatever horrible centrist, you know, they force us to take, you know, as the president or whatever. But she did not, as it turned out, successfully build a movement. What she did was coalesce a bunch of highly educated people around each other, but they were already coalesced together and they already knew each other. And it turned out that they, at some point, whether or not it was fair, turned off literally everyone else.
Yeah.
It's been wild because I hear so much about Sanders supporters being terrible on the internet, but a lot of that rage has been turned on me this week by Warren supporting friends who are grieving.
Oh, interesting.
And to some extent, look, you're grieving, but I was grieving too.
Yeah.
And I also feel like I've said this many times in the last few months. Movement politics resonates with me. I think I was uniquely positioned to both see what was going wrong with Warren and also understand what her appeal was and how it became so specific because I came from like with girls, I came from the perfect background to see both sides of that. I came from this white middle class, highly educated world. And I also grew up in like a movement household where we spent a lot of time engaged in movement politics. And so Sanders speaks to me in a way that he does not to a lot of my friends. And I get that. And I also see why they loved Liz Warren so much. And that also speaks to me. But listen, I whipped votes for her all over Tuesday because every single person who told me they hated Bernie Sanders, I was like, great. I have a candidate to sell you then.
Right.
So I whipped votes for her everywhere in LA
for
that entire week. I respect that she was a good candidate and I helped, you know, turn some voters. I helped turn a bunch of voters for her, knowing that Sanders sort of, as he had, this movement language was not going to appeal right. to all of these people that grew up in the same world that I grew up in. And I was happy to have a place to send them that was productive.
Right. Yeah.
But I was sort of like, you guys, I was here sort of defending your girl. And not only did she on election day basically tell me to fuck off.
Right.
But also now it is maybe time for you to listen to me talk about why Bernie Sanders is a good candidate.
Yeah.
Now maybe you can respect that.
Yeah.
In any case, one thing we will say about this race is anything could happen still. Because first of all, everyone is too old.
Right.
Coronavirus could take all of us out anyway.
Sure.
Especially people over 70.
Right. Right. it seems like the race, it feels like the race is cooked because they want you to feel like the race is cooked, but it could actually change on a dime. Yeah. Everything could change.
It did last week.
It did last week, and it could do it again. Exactly. And if you remember 2016, that was what was so weird about 2016, is it just seemed like every day the race was changing on a dime because we thought Sanders was cooked and he kept coming back and then he wasn't, you know, and then Hillary Clinton came back and then Sanders was still somehow coming back. And, then, you know, like the race isn't cooked until it's cooked. If you haven't voted yet, you should do what I said people should do on election day, even though Sanders supporters were saying that, you know, people should vote strategically for their candidate. I said and believe you should never vote strategically in a primary. You should only vote for what you actually believe. And then later worry about strategy if you have to choose between Joe Biden and putting your head through a wall. But, like, don't vote strategically in a primary. That defeats the purpose. How will they find out where their voters are?
Yeah.
In any case. Bloomberg dropped out, though. Thank you, Liz Warren, for that.
Yeah, exactly. Did you see that interview? Did you see her Rachel Maddow interview?
Yes.
It was really good because Rachel Maddow was just like, you know, you're kind of now widely credited as ending the candidacy of Michael Bloomberg based on that debate performance. She was like, was that what you were trying to do? And she was like, yeah. Like, she's like very matter-of-factly, like one word answer was like, yes.
She did do us a great service in preventing the possibility that a billionaire alone could buy the election.
Right, a billionaire Republican.
A billionaire Republican could buy the election. So that's good. Harris endorsed Biden today.
Like, duh.
Of course, we knew she was going to. Jesse Jackson endorsed Sanders, saying Medicare for All was one of the top reasons.
Right. Could have potentially used that this time a week ago. But
sure. People come to it when they
really
come
know,
to it.
I don't really know what it would have done. I think it would have helped marginally in South Carolina.
The other thing that I think that in the Sanders movement we should think about moving forward is the one area where I think we can really distinguish ourselves from the Biden coalition, if you will, is I think that we should refrain from blaming voters for anything. It is our responsibility to connect with voters. If we have not done that, and we obviously had not done that well enough on Tuesday, that is our fault. Just as, you know, I think with the Warren people too, like, that was not Bernie Sanders' fault. That was not Joe Biden's fault. That it is your responsibility as a campaign to tell voters why you're the best choice. If we have not done that, I think the one thing we can do on the left is not demonize people that we didn't get the message to. And I think they will do that on the right of the party. You know, the Biden coalition will demonize you for not getting their message that they didn't try to send you.
Yeah. They already started it. Blue, no matter who.
It's
exactly what that is. They're blaming you before you've even voted.
Exactly.
The last time they blamed you after you voted.
Yeah, because what is the right time to talk about where the Democratic Party should be, but if not the primary?
I know.
Like, somebody could send, well, I said on Twitter today, send me a calendar invite for when that time is.
Right.
Because if this is not the time, then I don't know what the time is.
Yeah.
But so, I think that we should make sure that as we do outreach to voters, we are not using that language to speak to them or to demonize them or whatever. Yeah. It is always our job to make sure our message is heard. It is not their job to listen.
Yeah.
It is our job to find the message that resonates with them. It is not their job to tell us what it is. And we should make sure that as we move forward, we're not echoing that just because the right wing of the party is echoing that, because I don't think that's a constructive movement building tactic.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if Bernie Sanders isn't the president, we still all got together and found out that there were all these people who wanted all the things that we wanted. We can make Biden's life a living hell.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. No, because
it's our responsibility to keep moving it forward. Bernie Sanders is an old man. He's not going to be here to be the main speaker forever.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But we're still all here.
Right. And I think that at a certain point, we're going to have, you know, I love Bernie Sanders. And, like, obviously his sort of, like, indignant rage at the system is what a lot of people like about him. But at a certain point, there will be a more palatable messenger of what he is.
Well, and there will be younger messengers.
Yes,
too.
Exactly. Younger
right.
messengers.
There's some really
right.
good people out there.
100%.
They've been, the sad part is that they've been kind of pushed out of the Democratic Party or
right.
they've been marginalized.
Right.
Yeah.
But there are some excellent people out there with some excellent ideas who explain this stuff actually better than Bernie does.
Yeah,
yeah.
Totally.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll come up. And,
oh, yeah,
but
for sure.
What we've got to do is make sure that we support them in Congress, and we support them if they're a governor. We support them wherever they are.
Right.
Yeah.
So that these policies can change.
Well, and also that we're ready to welcome them even if they are flawed in some of the ways that every candidate is flawed.
Yeah.
I think that's something like, you know, like I think someone like Ayanna Pressley is a perfect example.
Totally.
She, I don't know who she's going to endorse. Maybe she'll just stay out of it until the, you know, election is cooked.
Yeah.
Maybe she'll go with the rest of the squad and endorse Bernie. Maybe she won't. She's such an important asset as a speaker, and because of that, I don't think that the left, whatever choice she makes, as long as her message is a progressive message, the left should make sure we're there to welcome her.
Yeah.
When she finds us again, you know,
right.
like, or if she, I mean, she might find us, she might already have found us. But I mean,
well,
like that, we should make sure that someone like that becomes part of the tent that we're building.
I agree. There's a, it's Anand, Gerard Artis, who has some sort of like thing that he says all the time. And it's something to the effect, I might not get it perfect, but it's like, you know, does the woke left have, you know, room in their tent for the still waking?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I think that we have to make sure that we do. And that, like, truth be told, is a problem that a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters have, where it's like, if you are sort of like not, you know, as strident on literally every single thing, then you're a traitor. And like, we shouldn't be doing
that. I think part of what happens is that for the Sanders left, a lot of these issues are really personal. You know, I was talking to someone earlier this week about why Sanders supporters get so nuts on the internet. Because there's the sort of doxing end of the Sanders world, which is like not an acceptable place to be, regardless of who you love. But there's also the end of the Sanders world where people just make a lot of snippy comments on the internet.
Sure.
And I think part of it is watching people sort of trivialize really present concerns in their lives as if these are just not, there's not time, there's not will, there's not possibility. Like, for things that are really critical to people's happiness, things like having access to healthcare, things like not being in hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt at the age of 22, things, you know, some of the issues that Bernie Sanders talks about, the reason that young people have fastened onto them is because these are actual, like, critical life or death issues to them.
They're life-saving, or life-changing.
Right, they're life-changing. And so for, I think, what you see with Sanders supporters getting nuts, a lot of it is coming from a place of panic.
It's coming from a place of panic. And I also feel like the one, this is what I have been saying too, because I have been thinking about this too. Like, why, you know, it's like in 2004, I was a huge Howard Dean fan and he lost that primary and that was like a bummer for a day and then you moved on with your life.
Right.
Like, what is, I feel like so much of what people love about Sanders is some of those policies are really sort of like, they're like, they're hopes and dreams.
Yeah.
So like when those things, so when those things get trivialized or you're made to feel like that you're silly for getting sold a bill of goods or something like that, it feels like you're, it, like, this sounds cheesy, but it feels like your dreams are being trampled
on.
And they are, but on Wednesday morning, when
I woke up, the thing that was bringing me down is I felt hopeless.
Right. And that is why it's easy to, and that's why It's you know, because I even had someone say this to me. It's just sort of like, well, the Buttigieg supporters moved on.
Right.
But like, that was a bit, that was
yeah,
nothing.
What did
that
they
was
believe?
A campaign. That was a campaign about nothing. It was like a Seinfeld campaign,
right.
basically. I mean, like, you know, and the same with some of these other people who have dropped out. It's like, well, who cares? Like, they weren't, none of their supporters actually had anything wrapped up in those people.
When I think that's the difference that, you know, that's why we're seeing this huge outpouring for Warren's campaign, because I think
some
wing of that party, of that coalition,
totally
cared deeply about these
100%.
Issues. And I think that's why,
none of the Klobuchar supporters were crying on Monday after she dropped out.
No.
They were like, well, I'll vote for Biden now.
Right.
You know?
Or
I mean,
I'll vote for Warren or whatever weird calculus people were making with that campaign. But I mean, I think the thing that is different, I was not disappointed on Wednesday. I felt hopeless, and not because Bernie Sanders would never be the president or anything like that. I mean, this for me is not really wrapped up in Bernie Sanders himself. He is like a good mouthpiece through which these ideas flow. It was because I woke up that morning and thought, am I never going to fucking have affordable health care in my whole fucking life?
Yeah.
That's what I woke up feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that understanding that sort of, not just that rage, but that sort of hopelessness and sadness
yeah.
is part. I mean, that's, I think, what the left can try to, you know, organize around that feeling.
Yeah.
But the sort of right wing of the party is never going to meet us there.
No.
No.
They don't care if we feel hopeless.
But also, I think part of it is there are so many people, so many new people to this process that came in after Trump was elected president. And so they really don't. I mean, I am so sick of losing, I can't tell you, because like 50 years of losing, I can't even watch election returns anymore because I go into this deep despair. But I, at the same time, what I'm finding is a lot of the newer people, and it's not only young people, it's also older people too, who, I mean, the Women's March in 2017 brought this huge group of middle-aged women into this whole thing. And I think that their priorities are not well established because they don't really know. I mean, I think of someone who I know who is, he's a Democrat and he's, you know, I think he got into it within the last 3 or 4 years or something. And he is so angry at me and everyone because Bernie isn't a Democrat.
Right.
And he's like, classic. Are you kidding me?
Right.
You know, and I
was he voting for Bloomberg?
I don't know, but it was like it he didn't get, first of all, because he's become a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
that there are a lot of Democrats who cannot stand the
but
party.
That's part of the nature of being a Democrat, is hating the Democratic Party.
Exactly,
it has been for years.
And so they're like coming up with this stuff and they're kind of feeding on their on each other because they really don't have the perspective to
I think this is something we talked about a little bit after 2016 as well, because I think one thing that having parents who were part of the left before this gifted me was some context, because when I remember specifically with the Michigan gubernatorial primary when Abdul El-Sayed won 30% of the vote, and I was like, can you imagine a progressive winning 30% of the vote? Like, he didn't win. And that sucked.
Yeah.
But, like, it was, like, we had never, they had never even tried running a progressive in any of those races.
Right.
So, like, 30% of the vote, I was like, well, we did it, you guys.
Yeah.
30% in, we've never even done more than 5%. I mean, what's going on here? Like, I think it helps to be able to read some of the context, to see where the victories are. I mean, my mom's been talking about how, you know, in 2016, we were seeing that maybe 30% of the party supported progressive policy or was voting for progressive candidates. And now 45% is voting for progressive candidates and 65% supports progressive policy.
Right.
That's a huge shift and that's really valuable.
And even just going off of that, you know, Michigan gubernatorial primary that you were talking about, where we ended up was Gretchen Whitmer, who is not even really a moderate, you know?
Right.
I mean, like, at the time, anyway, when she was running in that race, I mean, she was also in favor of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And at the time, that's, like, a no-brainer now. Like, if you're running for president, you have to think that. But 4 years ago, you didn't have to think that, and she did. She was also in favor of, you know, the previous Republican president or governor had not expanded
Medicaid.
And she was like, you know, I mean, like, so there were things that it was just sort of like, the fact that, and I don't know that she would have got there by herself.
Having the conversation is valuable.
But I think also one thing that we all, especially for people who are, quote, progressives, and I hate that word because actually progressivism came from Teddy Roosevelt and it was originally a Republican concept.
Right. Well, now all Democrats should think they're progressive.
Yeah,
so it doesn't mean anything.
That's one of the differences between Democrats and Republicans is even if Democrats don't agree with you, you can have the conversation. You cannot have the conversation with Republicans. Mm. They will not talk about Medicare for all or doing anything for health care. They will not talk about...
Right, they've been devoted to obstructionism for so long
so
that they don't...
So even though there are people running on the Democratic Party who seem very kind of traditional and not really with it, you'll still be able to have the conversation with them and you'll be able to move them, especially if all of us have that position and they realize that.
Well, that's, I think, just being able to say a majority of the Democratic Party supports Medicare for All.
Right.
That is because somebody said the words Medicare for All at some point, that person being Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And then everyone had to find out what it was. And then they were like, wait a minute, this might be a good idea.
Right.
If you don't have a conversation happening inside of the party, you don't get to see any progress. And so I think a lot of people who are new to the process have also not been ever part of that process, where the left has to pull the center to them,
right,
using Well, and I mean, I think the thing that actually taught me this was not really within the Democrats. It was the Green Party. Yeah. We have family members for the Green Party, and they'll only vote for the Green Party, and they're very serious about the Green Party. But the way that I see the Green Party is the Green Party comes up with ideas that are fringe ideas at the time. And then one day, the Democratic Party is talking about the Green New Deal. And like, where did we get that from? We got that from the Green Party. They had a Green New Deal long before we did. Who were the first presidential candidates like to talk about Medicare for All?
Right, they're like a feeder
party. It was Green
party.
Candidates. Yeah, right. They're like a feeder party. And so you have to start the conversation somewhere. And if one, I mean, we have that conversation now finally coming from inside the party, which we had never in my lifetime had.
Yeah.
So there is progress to be had. But I think you're right that people that are newer to the process are not familiar with the process
right.
as much. And so oftentimes
right. so
they get
people, the Green Party
really
and
nuts.
The progressives are just that they're evil.
Right.
Yeah.
right.
But
exactly.
also I think that young people, especially young people and people who have never been engaged before, they think when you have elections and you work really hard that you win.
Right. And progressives, I'm sorry to announce,
right.
never
Isn't that
win.
Charming?
right. exactly. That's not how progressive That's politics how works, you guys. And on that note, let's talk about how our Senate candidates did. Because my mother had graciously done a lot of research for our Senate project.
Yeah.
Once the primary results are in, we're going to start giving you information about how you can support some of these Democratic challengers in states that have Senate races going on. North Carolina voted on March 3rd, and they unsurprisingly elected Cal Cunningham to run against Tom Tillis in November. He's the DSCC endorsee,
sure.
super boring guy, very Bruce Braley-esque.
Yeah. You know, look, if anybody's gonna elect a real boring white guy, it's the people of North Carolina.
Exactly. So who am I to?
Yeah, he's attractive, and he has a military
background. Well, he must.
Oh, well,
the
DSCC is,
right,
is
they
only endorsing
right,
people who
right,
have been in the
right.
military. So
yeah, and I believe he was even in Congress for one term
a while ago. Yeah,
but we've reached out to his campaign because we want to find out what kind of options there are for out-of-state voters, because one of the things we're trying to do is encourage people who live in states where there are no Senate campaigns this year, like in California or New York or Pennsylvania, that they kind of adopt a senator. Because we all should be really, really angry at the Senate and the way they told us in January that they don't think they have a job to do here.
Yeah.
Thing. They basically said, no, we can't, you know, we don't do anything. They have not, under Mitch McConnell, they have not done anything for many, many years. So basically, it's not only getting Mitch McConnell out, but it's also bringing in enough Democrats so that the Democrats have a majority.
Yeah. And actually, I wanted to say something about this because I had a conversation with someone whose opinion I value, who said that, you know, she's against sort of political tourism, as I was terming it. And I was like, you know, in certain races, I am too. I am against political tourism. I don't think people should come from out of state and tell us who the mayor of LA should be. You know, I don't think that people should necessarily even come from out of state to tell us who the congressional candidate here should be, because that is, everyone has an equal is equally represented in Congress, aside from the people of D.C. and Puerto Rico. I mean, I get, you know, everyone who has a congressperson who is a voting congressperson is equally represented. It's not really your decision who wins someone else's district. However, I feel differently about the Senate. And I feel differently about the Senate because the Senate is not a Democratic institution, and the Senate has a huge amount of control over all of our lives.
Yeah.
We in California have the least representation in the Senate of anyone who has a senator.
Yeah.
Again, I recognize that Puerto Rico does not have a senator, that D.C. does not have a senator, that Guam doesn't, you know. But of the 50 states, we have the least representation of anyone. So we deserve to have our hands all over these fucking Senate races.
Right.
Because our will is constantly trampled by the Senate. And
well,
so if it's not going to be a Democratic institution, we don't have to obey Democratic norms to participate in it.
Well, and especially as you said, you know, we don't have a Senate race. And New York doesn't
have
a Senate race. So
let's
pretend like we do.
Yeah, we have reason to be really upset with the Senate and want the Senate.
And we also have reason to believe that senators from out of state should have to represent us too. Because no one is representing us.
Right.
So we should make our will known.
Yeah.
In any case, in Texas, there was also a Senate primary. That was the MJ Hager race. She is going to be in a runoff in May against Royce West, who I believe was a state senator or state assemblyman there.
A state senator there. Yeah.
She got 22.3% of the vote. He got 14.5% of the vote. There were about 1,000 people running in that Senate race. And so they were going to face off to see who is going to face John Cornyn in November.
Yeah.
In May, Sadly, Jessica Cisneros lost her race by like a tiny margin. If that Biden thing hadn't happened, I think she probably would have won it.
Yeah.
It was a close race. It was 51.6 to 48.4. But hopefully this is laying groundwork that is important in the, you know, Congress people come up every 2 years. So we can try this again soon. So hopefully this is something that we will continue to chip away at. Here's just what I'm going to make a weekly reminder that the Arkansas Democrats ran nobody against Tom Cotton.
Yeah.
Try something. Literally
especially
anyone.
Especially because of his positions on coronavirus. He would be kind of vulnerable now.
Right.
Because he's a real conspiracy.
If it's a high-level seat like that, don't not run anyone.
Right?
Just
I know.
Do something.
Well, and also, like, in Arkansas, that's like the type of place where it's like they have elected Democrats before, lest we forget, that's where Bill Clinton came from. You know, he was the governor for 1,000 years. Not really, but I mean, he was elected multiple times.
Did you know we just learned something really important at dinner last night, which was that Bill Clinton was very young when he was elected president.
Yeah.
He was in his late 40s.
Oh, yeah, because he was 32 when he was elected governor.
Yeah. We had been thinking he was older, and then we kept trying to do the math, and we kept being like, no, our math is wrong. It wasn't.
But, you know, you never know when, like, look, you might lose to Tom Cotton. Who knows?
Yeah.
But also, Arkansas is the type of place that could very quickly, in a Republican primary, end up with someone like Roy Moore or some terrible person that you might be able to, like, eke out a Senate race against.
But also, Arkansas is one of those places, it's a tornado away from wanting to get everybody out of office.
Yeah.
Oh,
because
for
that's
sure.
Because it's in Tornado Alley.
Right.
And, you know...
climate change should matter to Arkansas.
I mean, yeah, look, and I get it. Like, running against Tom Cotton right now might be a losing proposition. But, like, especially the state party there, like, has to just, like, find a warm body, you know? I mean, it's just, like...
He's one of those who's planning to run for president.
100%.
Yeah.
You know?
Right,
yeah.
Get in there and make sure that someone's vetting the guy.
Yeah.
There are also some interesting races in California that we thought we'd update you about. Because, as you know, we have a wacky system here.
Right.
Jungle primaries sometimes make for very exciting... elections. Yeah. So in Nancy Pelosi's district, a progressive has advanced into the election with her. He only got 12.7% of the vote, but he's a constitutional lawyer and part-time DJ. But he's a graduate of Stanford Law. He's a credible person.
And it's the first time that she has had this, actually, ever.
She normally runs unopposed.
She's not had to do this. Yeah.
First of all, no matter how powerful you are.
And she's probably run against Republicans before.
Yeah. Yeah, usually a Republican advances, and it's like, okay, well, you're in San Francisco. Who are they going
to
elect?
Yeah.
But this is something everybody should have to run a race for their seat, even if they are the majority leader.
Yeah.
And that includes Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi has, over her tenure, moved to the right quite significantly. She was representing a very progressive district when she took office, and she still is, but her positions have not sort of stayed progressive.
Yeah.
I believe, I have this in my brain, but everyone seems to have forgotten it, that she had said when she was speaker that she would only be speaker for these 2 years, and then she would step aside.
Which is funny, because Biden is running literally on keeping her speaker.
I know.
He's just like, let's keep every old person in office that we can and never change anything. But so, in any case, that's a race to keep your eye on, and if you are somebody that is interested in at least sort of giving Nancy Pelosi a progressive scare, get in
that's
there.
Happening.
That's a race if you're in California that you should have your eye on. The other is Katie Hill's open seat. So this was interesting because there were actually two primaries on the ballot for this seat. One was for the special election to fill the seat right now, and one was for the race in November.
Yeah.
So everyone who ran had to run in two different ballots, or two different races. Chrissy Smith did advance. But there was an interesting shakeup because Chrissy Smith got 36% of the vote in the Take the Seat Right Now race and only 29% in the race to move on to the primary for the November race.
Weird.
I don't know who was splitting their ballot on this race, but there was a big upset because Steve Knight, who had the seat before Katie Hill, had run in that race and was the Republican favorite.
Yeah,
and
he didn't
qualify.
Yeah.
Mike Garcia, who's a GOP state senator from the area, is who's going to run against her. And so they actually knocked Steve Knight out of his own district's race. Yeah.
Well,
Good for them.
I think Steve Knight hatred was part of what
drove
Katie Hill to decide to run and then also be able to win in that district. So it is kind of crazy
but
that he represented them.
He was considered
the
front runner and he was polling higher than anyone else and somehow still pulled pulled straight out of the race. Yeah. So that was fascinating.
Yeah.
Our next Senate primary that we that you should have eyes on is on Tuesday in Mississippi.
Yeah.
That's Cindy Hyde-Smith's seat. If you want to know why she's terrible, I mean, she was an appointee, so she's not even been there that long. But she was the Republican senator who said, if he invited me to a public hanging, I'd be in the front row of Trump. So if you're wondering why she's terrible. Also, she's been pictured in Confederate garb.
Oh, sure.
And favors making voting more difficult for college students. So she's awful.
Yeah.
This is a seat. Mike Espy has already run for it. He's running again. He's considered the Democratic frontrunner. He's probably going to win the primary. He's very moderate. And I get that we're talking about Mississippi. So I'm, you know, what are you going to do? But he is... been sort of campaigning on not being a socialist, which annoys me. And he has come out against Medicare for All.
Oh, so sure.
He, you know,
classic.
Then there's this guy, there's a Bernie-crat running in this race who is both incredibly funny looking.
I'm
showing Brent a picture of him right now. He has a handlebar mustache of a sort that is.
It's a goatee.
Or goatee sort of mustache. It's unusual.
Yeah.
He is in favor of progressive positions, aside from he's pro-gun rights, because Mississippi. And he's also, he's pro-choice, but, like, against abortions in that weird gray area that people
classic,
fall into
yeah.
that's not great.
Right. I don't want people to have abortions, but they should be able to.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. He also ran for Roger Wicker's seat in 2018. So, you know, he's
right.
pinned to this rodeo before, but he's kind of the other person in that race, I guess, although I assume Mike Espy is pulling ahead of both of these. And then there's a guy, Toby Barty, who's a Navy vet who has served in the State Department and Homeland Security. The thing is that both with Toby Barty and Mike Espy, they don't have any issues really listed on their website.
No, obviously.
They're just running on their general-ness.
Yeah.
Their running-ness. So that's a little bit concerning. The Jensen Boren, who's the Bernie-crat, has nothing but issues listed. His website is... cornucopia of issues.
Right.
So that is, I don't know what that tells you, but it's something. And
I
then
I fear he probably has some own issues. Some
yeah,
of his own, right.
Exactly.
He's got political issues and
it's other issues.
Other
personal issues. Also, there's some filing deadlines coming up if you want to declare yourself for in a Senate race.
Sure.
Montana's is coming up on March 9th, so that's really coming up. In Idaho and Iowa are March 13th, Maine is March 16th, Colorado March 17th, South Carolina March 30th, and South Dakota March 31st. So those are all states where if you want to run for Senate in those states, you can still declare.
And that Montana March 9th filing deadline is important because there's a certain person who is going to be filing in that.
Correct.
Yes.
That
Steve
person
Bullock.
Being Steve Bullock, who finally got his act together.
Yes.
Stopped dicking around trying to pretend like he only wanted to be the president in a race that he never made even a single amount of traction in.
Right.
And is finally going to do what he should have done all along and run for Senate in Montana.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's some good news we got this week.
Yeah.
The presidential primary is coming up this week. There's March 10th is another big voting day.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's the next Superist Tuesday after Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
We have Idaho, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, and Washington voting. Michigan's the big prize of that bunch. Washington is the second biggest prize.
Right. Michigan, the biggest prize because A, it has the most delegates, but B, also it's Michigan. You know,
it's
state that we're going to need to win
in
the election in 2020. It's just,
Yeah.
So
and this is
that's
a state
where everybody's eyes are going to be on.
Polling is really close in this state between Biden and Sanders.
Yeah.
So
and Sanders has been living there.
Yeah.
Basically.
Oh, yeah.
So,
he's just going from college town to college town, throwing huge rallies.
That's where he was with
AOC and Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson, Rashida Tlaib. They were going around the other day because
she's from Michigan.
She's from there. So, yeah, he has been there.
Yeah.
That's
so,
where Bernie is.
We'll see
if you need him.
Right. If you need to find Bernie Sanders, Michigan, where the trees are all the right height, is the place to look.
That's right.
So that could be another crazy night. And then our next debate is March 15th.
I think this is going to be very telling, by the way.
They
March
just changed the format.
Debate. Right. It was Tulsi Gabbard had qualified herself per the last round of rules.
Yeah.
Because previously you just had to have won a delegate, and she has two now. So they immediately changed the rules.
Right.
So it will not be Biden, Bernie, and Tulsi Gabbard.
And if you had
Gabbard
forgotten, Tulsi
stage.
Gabbard is still running.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's still yet to drop out.
Right.
But I think, you know, there's been a lot of people sort of wondering about the potential mental decline of Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Whether fair or not, I don't know. I think in a two-hour one-on-one debate, we'll know whether that's fair or
not. Well, here's another thing that they just did, though. is they turned it into, it's basically a town hall style debate now where the audience is asking questions and they remain seated. Because it's two elderly men debating.
Right. Well, we know they can stand for that long.
One in mental decline. I know, they've been doing it. Exactly. Right? So they changed the format to suit the fact that it's only elderly men.
But that might be better because the audience may ask much better questions.
Well, they might if they vet the right questions. Right,
exactly. That's it.
If the audience was just free-form asking questions, I'd be like, let's do it.
Yeah. Right.
If the audience, and also if the audience had to pay $1,300 to get in there, then their questions are not going to be fair questions.
Right. No.
So that's another thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Meanwhile,
that'll be interesting, though. Just the two of them for a couple hours.
It's going to be, we'll see how that goes. Let me tell you something, you guys. It's going to be both weird and boring. There's literally no chance that it's interesting, but it will also be horrifying in certain respects. I say that as someone who's a supporter of one of the candidates. I just don't. And I would listen to Bernie Sanders talk for 2 hours, sure, knowing what I was getting myself into. I don't want to hear him in a back and forth with Joe Biden for 2 hours. Mm. I don't want to hear anyone in a back and forth with Joe Biden for 2 hours. And I certainly don't want to do that as the 10th or 11th debate I've had to watch this year. So we'll see what happens.
I might want to do that.
No, I'm going to watch it. I'm just going to be mad about it while I do it.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, there was a weird slip up in Klobuchar land this week where she accidentally told a bunch of Biden supporters in Michigan where she was campaigning for him that she would be, that she was honored to join his 2020 ticket.
Ticket.
Now, I have something to say before we get into, and listen, she could have meant campaign and said ticket, whatever.
100%.
The other thing is that Joe Biden should under no circumstances let her join his ticket.
I know.
Just use your head.
Yeah.
Amy Klobuchar doesn't buy you a single vote that you can't buy yourself.
Think about where you need help.
Right. And it's with everyone but Amy Klobuchar voters.
It is not with the boring women of Minnesota. Like, that's not where you're.
But by the way, you wouldn't even
so much. I mean, you know, she has 100 bills.
Right, that's right.
Passed. Oh, I mean, yeah.
Half
right.
of them being bipartisan bills that any moderate could pass if they didn't have principles. But
well, I have thoughts about where he should be looking for his vice president.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about it. I just don't believe that he'll listen to my thoughts.
Well, because he has some problems with some constituencies. Specifically, the Latino community.
Yeah.
For very specific reasons. Like, if you're wondering why Bernie Sanders is winning with the Latino community, there's two reasons. One is because he's done a good job with outreach and speaking to them. But the other one is their sheer hatred of Joe Biden.
That's right. Might remember that the Obama administration wasn't a high point in our history of deportation in America.
Well, it was the high point.
right.
It remains the high point, I think, actually.
I agree. Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that's right. It was not a positive point in our nation's treatment of the undocumented, shall I say.
Yeah.
And it remains a sticking point that is deserved.
Yeah.
And also maybe something that I've been thinking a lot about, like, what the value is of basically running on a third term of Obamaness, because the one thing that, and this was something I got into an argument with a friend about this as well earlier, where Obama himself is still popular. People love Obama. You can't transfer his Obama-ness to someone else. You can only transfer his platform. And his platform is the least popular thing about him.
It's true. Yeah.
Literally, that's true. People love Obama because they like
There's
the
Obama
person
nostalgia,
of Obama.
But that's and that's also just because of their newfound hatred of Trump.
Exactly.
Also, it's just like, wouldn't it be great if we had him back? But that's not because
his platform was so super fantastic.
Right.
It's because he himself made us feel calm and heard. Now, Joe Biden is not Barack Obama.
No.
He is the conservative running mate that was brought on to shore up the white conservative vote in when Obama was running for election as an almost progressive.
Right.
And then, you know, they basically pulled themselves back into a place of moderateness almost immediately. But there is a difference between running. I don't think anyone wants a third term of Obama-ness, actually. I think they would want a third term of Obama himself. But I mean, if I had to guess that the people would want, had nostalgia for a third of anything related to the Obama years, I would say that it has more to do with the person of Obama and the family and know, the fact that they love Michelle, the whole family. It's a great family. It has nothing to do with wanting the Obama platform returned.
No, it doesn't.
No one wants to go back to a time when we're just like bailing out big businesses and deporting everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what he exactly thinks he's promising us.
Yeah.
Won't matter soon because we're all going to be dead of coronavirus, especially if we attend conservative political conferences. Because CPAC and APEC both had coronavirus scares. Donald Trump is within two people of coronavirus right now.
Right.
Donald Trump is a germaphobe. So this is really great so news good. If you love torturing him. But there is a CPAC attendee who had coronavirus. Ted Cruz is now self-quarantining because he talked to the CPAC attendee.
Yeah.
Donald Trump shook hands with someone who shook hands with the CPAC attendee. So
yeah.
We could be seeing a Princess Cruise Line style dissemination of coronavirus among the conservative leading
Let's do it.
Elite. Yeah. I mean, it might be a nice way for them to learn about the importance of Medicare for All because...
Sure. And just at a... You know, they won't get there from this.
No.
But maybe science.
Yeah, maybe belief in science would be good.
Like, let's, you know, small victories.
Small victories.
Let's start small.
I was thinking about how if you are a person who is a rich person and you are thinking to yourself, well, I can just self-quarantine any day because I don't ever do anything for myself. I can move into a mansion that no one can ever see me in. I guarantee you have staff.
Right.
That is underpaid.
Right.
And that staff.
And you're not supplying them healthcare.
Right. You're the exact kind of person that's not giving paid sick leave and not creating a work environment where people feel safe taking paid sick leave and also probably not giving great health insurance.
Right.
So you're actually just quarantining yourself with coronavirus potentially while the rest of us just go out into the world living our lives.
Yeah.
I feel coronavirus just, it doesn't know how rich you are.
It doesn't.
It certainly, and you know what else doesn't know how rich you are? Your genes.
Right.
Your genes can't know. So if you're someone with a pre-existing condition or a pre-existing condition that is just being old.
Yeah.
And you're also very wealthy. A lot of very wealthy people are quite old.
Yeah.
This is really a time to think to yourself, would it be worth slightly more in taxes to make sure that my employees who are going to bring me all my food and are going to clean my house and take care of my children and do all of the things that I pay, you know, slave wages to people to do. Wouldn't it be nice if they could see a doctor and take time off if they got coronavirus so that I, a 70-year-old white man in a tower, do not get coronavirus?
Yeah.
I know they won't get there.
They won't get there.
But if ever there was a selfish reason to support Medicare for All, this is it.
Sure, yeah.
Medicare for All is a great policy if you... Listen, it's great if you're not selfish. I want everyone to have access to healthcare.
Right.
I want everyone to be out of chronic pain. I want all the things for everyone. I also want people around me to be able to see doctors when they have infectious diseases.
Yes.
Because I don't want to get an infectious disease. So
right.
in my most selfish brain, I still want Medicare for All to be the policy.
Right.
So if you are a person who is like a literal sociopath and only care about yourself, one great way to practice self-care is to make sure people around you aren't giving you disgusting germs.
Right. In a situation like this, you are only as safe from this thing as like what the least among us.
Right,
is,
the least insured person in America.
Yeah. So
and
the other thing, just like be able to sort of like take from this, like put, you know, I was telling you before we started, there was this story about how like the Trump administration had said that they might be willing to pay hospitals to pay for the care of people who have coronavirus.
Right.
Which is rich. And they should 100% do that. But also like anybody who is uninsured, who has some sort of, like, you should be able to see how this relates to covering everything else, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's an emergency for anyone who doesn't have healthcare, even if it's the flu.
Yeah.
Or if it's, I mean, or if it's as big as cancer or anything. Like,
also,
if you are uninsured, then, like, you can't pay for that either. So it doesn't matter that it's the coronavirus.
Also,
like, how is the coronavirus different from anything else that any uninsured person might get
helpful,
that they have to go to the hospital for?
How is it helpful to, I mean, how is it logical to not see how similar this just is to the flu?
Well, right.
I mean, like, at a certain point, like, infectious disease in particular is infectious disease always.
Right.
It doesn't, if the coronavirus is just a novel infectious disease, but that doesn't mean we haven't had dangerous infectious diseases out there.
Yeah.
Those dangerous infectious diseases are being coughed at you by uninsured people everywhere who can't afford to self-quarantine because they can't take the time off work and who can't afford to see a doctor to find out what precautions they should be taking or prescriptions they should be taking.
Right.
And therefore are just making you sick too.
Yeah.
Medicare for All. Let's end the podcast on a high note. There's one piece of just great news that came this week.
Yeah.
We did it, you guys. Chris Matthews is gone.
He's gone.
We worked at it.
Right.
We all got together and said once.
We sent the tweets.
Blinked our eyes at once. Right. And they finally, after only
Lila, he retired.
A few Nazi references.
Right.
Yeah, but you got rid of him.
Mixing up black people.
You know what, that was what got him, was that when he there said, oh, what is Jamie Harrison doing next to Lindsey Graham
and
the Republican rally on the night of the South Carolina primary. And it was so interesting because that happened, and then suddenly there was this woman who had made this comment or whatever. It got into the woman thing. It was not the woman thing. It was that he... Yeah.
No, nobody cares, apparently. Women being harassed is of no interest to anyone.
He's been doing that for many years.
Of course.
Well, I was going to say, that is a thing.
They've been covering for him for years. He's been harassing women this whole time.
Yeah.
But there, it was just one too many kinds of bigotry that came out.
Right.
And they finally thought...
It was the racism that finally got him.
That's right.
Yeah.
We got... There was anti-Semitism. There was,
sure, that was fine.
Misogyny, but they finally got him on racism. And look, at least whatever it takes, he's gone. He's gone. Off our television screens.
Yep.
So good riddance.
Ugh,
and
man.
Good night. Right. In any case, thanks to my mom for being our
Thank
guest.
Thank you for having me.
And also providing, I think, you know, we're always going on and on about boomers in this election. And I feel like...
I am an okay boomer, believe me.
Right.
I have one other piece of advice. This is my new thought on this all. Of how to take this election back into our own hands, and that is we need to go out and have fun.
Yeah.
David Platts, who I never agree with, has this theory that the election that has the most fun is the election. You know, the candidate and campaign that has the most fun is the candidate who wins. So I think if you're for Bernie, because I know Bernie people are a lot of fun, we've got to go out there.
Right, and that has not been our reputation of late. But if you're a person who is not on the non-internet section, the non-internet Bernie Sanders universe, then that is something you know. And if you're someone who's only interacted with Bernie people on Twitter, it's something you don't know.
Right. Right.
Exactly. Bernie people are really fun, you guys.
Yeah,
we're the best.
We're a fun bunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I like that.
Let's have fun.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.